Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome Dick Boak, Director of the Museum and Archives and Special Projects at C.F. Martin & Company. He is also the author and co-author of quite a few books like Martin Guitar Masterpieces and Martin Guitar History Revised. These are a must-have for any connoisseur of Martin guitars. Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by our friends at Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio, www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a great show for you tonight. Hey, Scott, how are you doing today?
I am doing good. I am super excited. We're having a guest on tonight as someone that I've been wanting to have on our show since the inception of our show.
That's true.
This guy is the man in my eyes, so very excited to have him on. But for those of you that have been paying attention to my YouTube channel, I just posted up a couple videos from our show last week with Thomas Nordig, who's Steve Vai's guitar tech and just a complete genius and all-around just fun guy, going through his different guitars that he has and the Steve Vai Evo signature model that he's adapted with the Antares auto-tune.
I definitely want to get one of those Sustainiacs. That thing is crazy.
Yeah, well, after hearing it, it's like it's totally Steve Vai's tone when you hear that Sustainiac, but wish they put it on more of his signature models, but it's the secret of Steve Vai. So
that's true. That's true.
Yeah, and I've also been checking out the new Audio-Technica System 10 wireless stomp box, which is really cool. And look for a demo of that coming up on YouTube, so you can visit my YouTube channel at Selenium. So that'll be very, very cool. What have you been up to, Jeff?
I got an announcement to make for concerning next week's guest that we're going to have on, Nick Kai. There's a benefit. This is kind of cool. There's a benefit for the Cancer Fund. It's from Ronnie James Dio. And it's happening right now. And it's over at the Avalon in Hollywood. And they're basically raising money for cancer. But the interesting thing is one of the guests that we had on, a very good friend, he was on a couple of weeks ago with us with Rowan Robertson. He's playing. So there's a bunch of people that are there right now. Hailstorm, Corey Taylor, Jason Christopher, Christian Martucci, Roy Mayorga, Oni Longin, Jimmy Bain, Rowan, and Brian Tishy. And I know that the thing's happening right now, so obviously those who are listening won't be able to go. But I want you to check out the docancerfund.org. If you can't afford it, you know, contribute because it's a good cause. And we'll talk a little bit about that next week when we have Nick on the show. So I just thought I would mention that.
I'm totally blanking right now. I'm trying to think of the Dio song that has to deal with
I think it has it's Stand Up and Shout is the song.
No, there's one about
that's what the whole
oh well there's
about.
There's a Dio song I used to have as my ringtone when I would go to church and my wife nixed it very quickly, but it was hilarious. Yeah. It's something to do with something about going to heaven or hell or something. I don't know. Either way, so it was quite funny. But well, anyways, why don't we take a quick little break and then we'll come back with Dick Boak.
Okay. Here we go.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here, one of the many guitar freaks at Sweetwater. We are so proud to support the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show. Check out our amazing guitar gallery on the web at sweetwater.com. Click on our guitar gallery link and you can see a bunch of pictures of each of the thousands of actual guitars we have in stock. What a great way to pick out your new baby's finish, wood grain, or serial number. Or call us at 800-222-4700 and speak to a professional guitar enthusiast directly. This week, the Flow welcomes Dick Boak of C.F. Martin Guitars. Now, just about anybody that knows acoustic guitars loves Martin guitars, and Dick knows Martins as well as anybody on the planet. Martin Guitars brings so much joy to so many people, you won't want to miss this one. So dig this week's Flow, and be sure to check out our guitar gallery at sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Thanks for listening, and this is Kenny Burgle with Sweetwater saying, rock on with the flow.
Hi, I'm Richard Kotzer from the Winery Dogs, and you are listening to The Flow Guitar Enthusiast.
Well, we're welcome back, and I just want to, again, welcome and very honored to have Mr. Dick Boak from C.F. Martin on our show. Welcome, Dick.
Well, hi there.
Well, so let's just get started. Tell us the story of how you got hired by Martin Guitar.
Well, it's one of those right place in the right time stories. I was teaching art in Blairstown, New Jersey, about 45 minutes from Nazareth. I grew up in a little town called Bethlehem, just below Nazareth, and driving from Bethlehem to Blairstown, I had to go right by Nazareth, and I saw a billboard for Martin Guitars about taking a tour. I didn't know anything about Martin Guitars, I've been trying to build guitars in my basement. They were just the most horrendous guitars you've ever seen, made out of plywood and cardboard and balsa wood and leather and anything I could find. There weren't any books or anything. So I decided to stop in and take the tour, and I was just flabbergasted by it. And I asked the receptionist if there were any scrap woods. I was teaching woodworking and art, and so the receptionist sent me around the back of the building, and I hit the jackpot. The dumpster was just filled with rosewood and ebony and spruce and mahogany and koa wood, and I pulled my Mustang around, and I filled my car up, and I came back about an hour later and filled it up again, and over the course of about 4 years of teaching, I think I came back to the dumpster about 500 times. I eventually left teaching and opened up a little art gallery in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and kept coming back to the dumpster, and they knew me pretty well by then. At the back door, there was all the workers at Martin were Pennsylvania Dutch, and Harvey Samuels, who was the foreman of the machine room at the back door near the dumpster, saw me fully immersed in the dumpster, and he said, "Well, what do you do with this stuff anyhow?" And I had a couple of instruments in the car that I had made, and handed them up to him, and he said, "Do you mind if I parade them around the shop once?" And off he went with my instruments, and he must have run into C.F. Martin III, Chris Martin's grandfather, who at the time was about 80 years old. And C.F., Mr. Martin, as we called him. He wanted to be called Fred, but we called him Mr. Martin. And he said, "Tell that kid to apply for a job." So Harvey brought the instruments back, and he said, "The old man says you should apply for a job." That's C-H-O-B. And I had kind of an afro haircut, and I was covered in sawdust. But I brushed off, and I went around to the front of the building, and I talked to the same receptionist, and I said, "I'd like to apply for a job." And she said, "I don't think we have anything for you." And I said, "Any openings whatsoever?" She said, "There's one opening. It's very specific. It's design drafting. So I said, "I've been teaching design drafting for 4 years, and I have examples of my draftings in the car." And she said, "We're really looking for somebody that has some experience with woodworking." And I had a jewelry box and some lathe turnings that I made out of their scraps. And she said, "Well, we're really looking for somebody that has some experience with musical instruments." And I said, "Well, here's two guitars I made, and the old man says I should apply for a job." So reluctantly, they brought somebody from Human Resources up and interviewed me. And said, "Eventually, can you start tomorrow?" And I said, "No, I have to go to the Bob Dylan concert. I can start on Wednesday." So that was 38 years ago, and they didn't realize at the time that I probably would have done the job for free. It's just a fantastic place, a fantastic product, a really nice blend of art and creativity and music for me.
Yeah, it's now afterwards when you started working there, did you ever run back into Mr. Martin and did he make the connection to who you were?
Oh yeah, well, we became great friends and you know, they called me the kid or the new kid in town, you know, from that Eagles song. Pretty soon I established myself as a character. We had a Christmas party just about a month and a half after I started, and they found out that I played music, and Frank Martin, who is Chris's father, asked me to bring my auto harp. In the middle of the party, they announced that I was going to play a set, and it kind of caught me off guard. But I was so on that night. I just was supercharged, and I gave a great performance, and everybody in the company knew me, and CF he actually fell and hurt his leg and started walking with a cane. And I noticed that he was having trouble with the cane, that it wasn't a comfortable cane for him. So I had some really beautiful rosewood turning squares that were large enough to make a cane, and I made a beautiful rosewood cane with D45 inlays in it and gave it to him. You know, we were pretty close. He eventually invited me to join the Lions Club. He was one of the charter members of the Nazareth Lions Club. And the Lions Club was not exactly my thing, but I joined specifically so that I could drive him to and fro. He couldn't drive anymore. And it was really, really special to pick him up and talk about the old days of buying rosewood, going down to the docks along the Hudson River, and to the sawmills and picking out the logs and everything. Incredible stories that he told me. Like I said, we became very close friends.
Are those were those car drives with him? Were they what started piquing your interest into getting into the history of Martin and preserving it?
Well, I was so hungry for everything Martin from day one. In the drafting job, I was totally immersed in the dimensions of every guitar and mandolin and banjo and everything that we made. I was just soaking it up. And after going home at night, I would experiment with instrument making at night and over the weekends. And it was just a complete guitar immersion. Mike Longworth was a historian then and very active running customer service and answering all the inquiries about the history of guitars. And I learned a tremendous amount as his good friend. I guess I kind of naturally became the successor to Mike Longworth because I was the one that knew where everything was and had the best sense of the history of the company.
So did you work directly with Mike for a while, or when it was established you were going to kind of take over from him?
It wasn't established. It just was logical. When Mike left, I was the natural person to do it. I had worked over at North Street. I started a store over there called Woodworker's Dream. And in the several years that I was over at North Street, there were three different attics at North Street. The attics were filled with old tools, coffin cases, boxes and boxes of correspondence that were covered in a half an inch of sawdust. I knew every square inch of that building. I knew where everything was. And after Mike left and moved down to Tennessee, he kind of coached me a little bit as a satellite and let me know where things were. And it was really the book projects that got me into the old attic at North Street where the boxes of correspondence were. And they hadn't been touched in probably 50, 60, 70 years. And I brought them all over to Sycamore Street, and working with Richard Johnston, Writing the book, which is called Martin Guitars, America's Premier Guitar Maker. We went through the correspondences, and we found letters from 1830 all the way up through the 1940s, and more than 700,000 documents. A lot of the early ones in German, I'd have to say that I don't have enough RAM in my brain to store all of this information. But the researchers and authors that I've been privileged to work with have agreed to share everything that they researched and revealed with me and with the Martin Archives, and it's grown tremendously in the last 15 years.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the other interesting thing about Mike Longworth, besides being the guy that kind of wrote the first edition of that book that you're talking about, right, is mm-hmm. that he was the one that brought back the D45, correct?
That's right. He was a Pearl inlay expert. He had done a lot of special inlays for people like Lester Flatt, a lot of the bluegrass people. So when Mike came to Martin, he came specifically for the purpose of bringing back the Pearl inlay. The D45s from the pre-war period, they were suspended because of difficulty in securing materials, and also the economy was such that people couldn't really afford premium guitars like that. But by the mid-60s, there was a big demand for them, and Mike was brought back specifically to do that. So he also introduced the D41, and established a little Pearl department with a couple of Pearl inlay experts that he trained. And, Pearl inlay doesn't do anything to the tone of a guitar, but it sure is beautiful, and it's a fantastic art.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I have a guitar that I was blown away when we met you over at NAMM. I showed you my little business card, and it has like a tiny picture the size of a centimeter of me holding a guitar, and you were able to pick out that guitar and what year and. But it was
you can blindfold me and I can tell what it is just from the smell.
Oh, well, the smell of this is fantastic. Only if people could smell it. It's just amazing. I don't even think a vintage guitar beats the smell of the inside of these guitars, but I have.
Well, it's a mixture of spruce, Spanish cedar, rosewood. They all blend together and sometimes a little bit of mustiness or mold from age or from a moist case, and it's it's an unforgettable smell.
You know, Yankee Candle Company should make a scent.
Yeah, we've tried to figure out how to can it. You know,
you should. That would be awesome. I'd love to have one for my car. one of the new books that's coming out, you weren't necessarily the author, but I know that I'm sure you were way involved with this. The Inventing of the American Guitar, basically a newer book on talking about the C.F. Martin One.
Yeah, it was written by Peter Zago and Bob Shaw, and it contains essays by a number of different authors, David Gantz, Richard Johnston, David LaPlante, Arian Sheets, and James Westbrook, all tremendous researchers and experts on guitars in general, but especially on early guitars. And the situation was that we didn't have a lot of information or knowledge about the instruments of C.F. Martin Sr. And about 4 years ago, we put together a little conference down in Philadelphia at Fred Oster's incredible shop, Vintage Instruments. And about 15 of us, and everybody brought examples of guitars from the pre-1860s era. And the idea was that we were just going to try and figure out the chronology and the evolution of how the guitar evolved from a Viennese European instrument into the guitar that we know of today. And in our first conference, we were just amazed at how much information came out from inspecting the braces and measuring the instruments and taking photographs and just talking about them. And over the course of about another year and a half, we did a ton of research in the archives, had some of the letters translated, and gleaned a lot of information from the really early journals that the Martin family saved. And we held a second conference, and this time around we gathered about 50 or 60 instruments from the pre-1860 time period. And by then we had a real sense of the chronology. And all these instruments were in one room on guitar stands, and everybody just was moving them around and saying, well, this one goes before this one, and this label predates this label, and we put them in what we believe is perfect chronological order. And from that, we could see a pretty definitive evolutionary line of how the guitar morphed into really the early Martin guitars that defined what the instrument is today.
Well, let me ask you this question. So doing this, what did you guys discover or learn anything new regarding to the time period of the X bracing?
Well, sure. You know, the really early guitars from Europe were ladder braced, which means horizontal braces perpendicular to the fingerboard or parallel to the frets. These braces were inhibitive to the tone. They didn't do anything for the tone. They were put in simply for strength. The Spanish guitars of that time, most of which were made on an island called Cadiz, had fan bracing. Sometimes they had three fans and sometimes they had five. Martin started getting orders in New York City from his distributor, John Cupa, who was from Spain, specifically for a more Spanish-styled guitar. And so Martin very quickly enhanced the tone of the guitars by switching from the ladder bracing to the fan bracing. The problem was that Martin really liked pin bridges. By that I mean bridges that have bridge pins instead of tie bridges like a classical guitar.
Right.
And every time he was drilling the holes for the bridge pins, he was running into the fan braces. Well, this was a problem, and so he started to angle those fan braces, swing them out, and realized that he could eliminate the transverse bar below the sound hole and extend the fan braces and form an X. So around 1842, 1843, Martin built a guitar specifically for a fantastic guitar player, probably the finest guitar player in America, named Madame Dolores Navarez de Goni, a very exotic Spanish guitarist that had emigrated to America and was touring from Maine down to Texas doing little guitar shows. And she came to Martin's house in Nazareth. That would be after he moved from New York City out to Pennsylvania. And she had no intention of getting a Martin guitar, but CF Senior had made her a special instrument for her to try. She picked it up very skeptically, played one chord, and clearly, it blew the socks off of the guitars that she had brought with her from Spain, and she became an endorsee of Martin, because he made replicas of her guitar called the Degoni model, and the X brace caught on. And I guess the reason why is that it used less wood. It had a better tone, and it distributed the tension from the strings onto the shoulders of the guitar, so that the tone could just really, really present itself.
What body shape would you equate that to now?
Well, these were ladies' guitars primarily. They were called ladies' guitars. They were small instruments that were used by women in the parlor of the home to entertain their house guests, mostly at tea time or after dinner, and hence they became parlor guitars, or that's how they're known. Martin made a lot of different sizes. Size 5 was the smallest. We still make a size 5 called a Terz guitar, tuned 3/2 steps high from G to G, and wonderful little guitars. So that was the smallest size. And the sizes, as the numbers decreased, the sizes increased. So size 4 was a little larger than size 5. Size 3.5, size 3, size 2.5, size 2. Those were really the most popular ones. And then size 1 was the largest. I think what happened gradually is that the banjo was such a loud instrument that the guitar just couldn't compete. The small guitars couldn't compete with the volume of the banjo. And so the guitars kept growing. From size 1, they ran out of numbers and went to size 0, which the Germans called Ott. So an Ott-size guitar was an O. A little bit bigger was a double Ott, and bigger yet was a triple Ott, or triple O. And these were all 12-fret guitars, and the triple O being the largest of the 12 frets. So that one emerged around the turn of the century, and really matured in the hands of Jimmy Rogers in the 20s, the father of country music.
Well, let me ask you, since we've talked about different sizes of guitars and X-bracing, in your opinion, which has affected the American guitar tone, or even Martin's tone, more, X-bracing or a D-body style?
Well, you know, we make so many different body styles, and every single one of them has its place, has its genre. You know, smaller guitars typically have a brighter response, whereas larger guitars have a warmer, bassier, more resonant response. And each can be glamorized or criticized in different ways. Dreadnought guitars are very loud and powerful, and they fit the bill for vocal accompaniment and competing with other instruments on stage. But they, in a studio, they can be a little boomy, a little bass heavy. And conversely, the smaller guitars are crisp and clean, but they sometimes lack the bass response. So from my perspective, I think there are some sweet spots in particular guitars. I'm a big fan of the orchestra model, which emerged around 1930. The orchestra model, or OM, is a long scale instrument where the strings are stretched tightly onto a triple O sized body. And this is what Eric Clapton plays. The orchestra model is extremely versatile. It has a balance, the same type of balance that jazz players look for all the way up the neck. It has balance between bass and treble. It's not bass heavy, it's not treble heavy, but it's even across all of the registers. And I think it's just the sweet spot. I also am really, really fond of 12 fret guitars, because even though you don't have as much access up the neck, the extra cavity above the sound hole creates a hollowness, a depth that's hard to get from any other instrument.
All right, well, let me put you on the spot again a little bit. If you were to make a Dick Boak signature model, can you describe what body style and woods you would use?
Well, that's a tough one. You know, I've lent my name to a number of guitars where I've actually signed the interior labels. I love small instruments, and I was up in the attic and looking through all the old wooden molds and fixtures from the old guitars, and I came across the size 5, which is the smallest of the guitars. And I just thought it was so cool to have a little guitar that was still extremely serious. So I dusted off the molds and I took them down into production, and I ordered up a custom guitar, a little size 5 with an Adirondack spruce top and rosewood back and sides. Fancied it up a little bit with herringbone and a pearl rosette and some nice fingerboard inlays, and had a custom guitar made. And when it was finished, a lot of my coworkers hadn't seen one of these and didn't really understand what they were or how good they were. So this one was tuned, like I said, 3 half steps above standard pitch. And I strung it up with high strings, like Nashville tuning. Mm-hmm. And it just had a crystalline harpsichord-y type of tone that is totally different from a standard guitar. I just fell in love with it, and everybody that I showed it to thought it was great. And we eventually came out with a limited edition called the Mini Martin, based on that guitar, and it did quite well. And the surprising thing was that all of the professionals, Eric Clapton and Mark Knopfler and Paul Simon and Sting and even Bruce Springsteen and Stephen Stills, on and on and on. They all fell in love with these, and in every one of those guitars that I shipped, I included a little letter with a special set of strings that was my high string Tours set, and I signed all the labels. And so in effect, that was kind of my signature model. And I love it, and every time people come to Martin, I show it to them, and they just, their jaw drops how inspiring it is.
Now, did you guys use X-bracing inside of that too? Or?
Oh, sure. I can't think of any guitars that we're making that aren't X-braced. From the tiniest, well, the ukuleles of course are now X-braced, but from the tiniest little guitar, the tiniest little size 5, all the way up to the grand jumbo, which is bigger than a dreadnought.
Wow. Now, one of the things that you've also done is you've worked with many artists on creating their signature models. I mean, even back to one of the very first with Gene Autry. Can you tell us some fun stories of different artists you've worked with and maybe some of the more unique ones?
Well, first, I have to credit Chris Martin for having the vision or the open-mindedness to do this. Chris visited the Gene Autry Museum out in Hollywood, and in a display case, Gene's D45, his 12-fret D45, which was the first D45 ever made, was on display and considered one of the most valuable instruments in the world. And Gene was still alive at the time, and Chris went up to the gift shop and saw Gene Autry lunchboxes and Gene Autry keychains and Gene Autry everything, and thought, well, maybe Gene would agree to have Martin replicate his famous Martin guitar. And so we proposed that, and Gene, of course, was excited, but required that we pay a royalty to his museum, which was a nonprofit. And Chris loved the idea that we weren't doing typical endorsements where you pay people money to play your guitar. That seems ingenuous to us. We like the idea of the charitable aspect. So we did the Gene Autry project, and it was a success. And I followed it up by suggesting to Chris that we contact Derek Clapton. And I can't take total credit for that, because what happened is after the MTV Unplugged performance that Eric did, everybody was calling me up on the phone and wanting to know what Eric was playing. He was playing a 1939 Triple O 42, and a second Martin guitar, which was a Triple O 28 that Mike Longworth had converted into a 45. Those two instruments, we didn't offer them anymore. And after the Clapton performance, there seemed to be quite a demand. So I went into Chris's office and asked if I could contact Eric. And Chris said, as long as there's a charitable aspect to the project, he was fine with it. So I went and dashed off a email to Eric's manager, Roger Forrester at the time. And I got a message back from Eric the next day saying how excited he was to do the project. And that guitar, the guitar that we designed together, it's called the 00042 EC, and it actually combined the elements from both of those two guitars that he used on MTV into a beautiful, beautiful guitar. You know, it's not enough just to put somebody's name on an instrument. You've got to have a great product, and if there's a great product, everything else will fall into place.
Is that the one that you guys did that had Brazilian on it, or was that a later model?
No, the first model was Sitka spruce with East Indian rosewood, and gussied up pretty good with 42 style pearl. It was actually the first guitar that we used ablam on. Have you heard of ablam? It's laminated shell. It's real abalone pearl, but it's a six layer laminate of pearl, and the result is that you get much, much more beautiful color out of the pearl, and you don't waste as much of the shell. So the guitar was a limited edition of 461 instruments based on 461 Ocean Boulevard. I always like to pick a number that means something. And in fact, we had a guitar case with that edition that had a combination, a three-digit combination lock, and I set them all at 461. I thought that was clever. But the guitar, we took it to the NAMM show. It was a pretty aggressive project, a fair number of guitars to sell. They were gone in about an hour.
Wow.
You know, after that, Chris and the sales manager came up to me and said, what are you going to do next? You know, and I had been running the advertising department. And after that, I really focused on artist relations, left the advertising to other people, and just took off with limited edition signature models.
Go ahead, Jeff.
You had mentioned before the show, you were talking about some of the stories of some of these artists, and you had mentioned I heard a little bit of the story, and I'd like you to share with everybody about Joan Baez, and then you mentioned also something interesting about Paul Simon. Could you tell us those?
Well, every single guitar has stories. It's unbelievable, and that's what my book, Martin Guitar Masterpieces, is all about, is conveying the stories that happen with each guitar. And of course, Joan Baez's story is one of my favorites. Joan had been playing a very early 1920s 045, a beautiful, beautiful guitar. You see pictures of her at Newport Folk Festival with Bob Dylan, both of them playing that guitar. She played it throughout her whole career and continues to play it. And but what happened was I saw in one of the guitar magazines, I saw a picture of Joan, and she was holding a competitor's guitar, and it really upset me. So I called her office, and I said, talked to her assistant, and said, is something wrong with Joan's guitar? The next day I got a phone call from Joan, and she said, you know, I love my Martin guitar, but I was up in Seattle, and this fellow came up and said, you know, you really shouldn't be taking that Martin guitar out because it's worth about $1 million, and it's much too fragile. You should leave it at home. And he then presented her with one of his guitars, which was a copy of the Martin, same shape and size, but didn't really have the tone. So she came back and she put the Martin under the bed, and she started traveling around with this thing. And that's how I found out about it. And I said, well, Joan, how about we rectify this situation and do a little replica of the guitar that has the tone. And that's what we did. And in the meantime, her old guitar had a couple of issues. The binding had come loose. There was a couple of inlays missing. The fretting had worn a little bit. So I invited her to send it back to Martin, and she packed it up and insured it and sent it back with a courier, and it arrived and took it back to the repair people, and they inspected it. I was sitting up at my desk, and I got a phone call from Milt Hess, who was our best repairman, and he said, I think you better get down here. And I went down to the repair department, and he had an inspection mirror, and he was holding it with a light, looking into the inside of the guitar. And on the underside of the top, somebody had scrawled with magic marker, "Too bad you're a communist," onto the inside of the guitar. Wow. And he was worried that Joan would think that somebody at Martin did it. So he asked me to give her a call and tell her the story. So that's what I did. I called her up and I said, "Joan, are you sitting down?" And she sat down, and I said, "Somebody has written, 'Too bad you're a communist,' on the inside of your guitar." And there was dead silence for about 15 seconds. And then she broke out into a big laugh. She thought it was very funny. She surmised that during the Vietnam War, when her radical politics were pretty controversial, she had taken her guitar into a guitar repair store, and she had a funny feeling about the person behind the counter, and that his politics didn't match hers, and she suspected that that's probably where it happened. So that's the story. You know, I was prototyping the signature model 045, Joan Baez limited edition. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and it just occurred to me that I have to do that same thing to every one of the guitars. So I went to work the next day, and I made a label that fit up under the underside of the top that you could only see with an inspection mirror and a light, that said, "Too bad you're a communist." And we put that in every one of those guitars. Yeah, and the best part of that is that Joan just loved the story. And so in her concerts, she'd get about halfway through the concert to the point where she'd play the song Diamonds and Rust, and she'd tell the whole story about "Too bad you're a communist" to the audience.
That's great.
Fantastic.
What happened with the Paul Simon guitar?
Well, you know, I grew up, I knew every single one of Paul Simon's songs, and I was just such a fan of Simon and Garfunkel and of Paul and his solo career. So I was pretty nervous about meeting him. I had taken two guitars into New York City. It was a winter's day, a bleak and dark December. You know the lyric? and I was trying to figure out what I could take as a gift to him, and I remembered a lyric from one of his albums that was "Drank all the orange juice that we could hold." So I bought him a quart of fresh squeezed orange juice from the little deli down near his entrance.
Nice.
Took it up there, and this is at the old Brill Building, where all the songwriters, Tin Pan Alley and everything. Paul has his offices up there. But he wasn't there. His assistant and his guitar tech were there, but Paul had gotten delayed. So I set my guitars down by the front door and just sat and talked to the guitar tech for a while. And after about 45 minutes, the door creaked open, And Paul was wearing this huge Eskimo coat. I think he wore it on one of his album covers. The door creaks open, and he sees my guitar laying on the couch, picks it up, strums it, sets it down, and says, "I don't think so," and slams the door. And my jaw dropped, and I looked at the guitar tech, and I said, "Is that it? What just happened?" And he said, "I don't know." And there was dead silence, and 30 seconds later, the door creaks open, and Paul looks in and said, "Just kidding." So, you know, he has a long history with Saturday Night Live, and Lorne Michaels lives in his building, and he has a great sense of humor, and he's not scared to use it.
I actually remember, I'm originally from Illinois. I remember when he came on, and there was a senator in Illinois named Paul Simon, and they had a little bit
of
Saturday Night Live. So that was always kind of fun seeing him on there. can you tell us about some of the retro models that you guys are doing now and how that kind of brings back the old into the new.
Well, this was a project that, once again, inspired by Chris Martin, who likes to push the envelope and explore new territories for guitars. We of course have a long collaboration with Fishman Transducers. Larry Fishman is brilliant, and we feel that he's the leader in acoustic sound reinforcement. And we're always having discussions with him about the next best thing. There's always room for improvement. You know, there's a gap between pure acoustic sound of wood and what happens when you try to amplify it. And Chris's idea was to take instruments from our own museum and create algorithms based on those exact instruments, and then replicate those instruments in with vintage appointments, and install electronics that utilize the algorithms taken from the actual museum instruments to as closely replicate the tone of those guitars, which are, as you can imagine, you know, 50, 60, 70-year-old vintage guitars. The very best examples of Martin guitars from the pre-war era to try and get that sound. And so there's a fellow down in Nashville named Bill Vorndick, and he's an expert at recording and is largely behind the Nashville sound of a lot of the early country stars, has an incredible collection of microphones, vintage microphones, Neumanns and Sennheisers and everything you can imagine. So we took the instruments down there and recorded them with Larry Fishman and Bill Vorndick and a little crew of sound experts. And then Larry got to work and created algorithms for the Fishman Aura pickup and an electronic system that goes into the side of the guitar, fairly uninvasive. And he really did a great job. So those guitars are modern contemporary acoustic electric guitars with a fantastic vintage sound. So you have to use, for example, if you're building a D45, you've got to use a D45 algorithm. If you're building a D18, you've got to use a D18 algorithm. You can't mix them up. They're matched perfectly to their vintage museum piece.
Well, I mean, I have to say, honestly, the next Martin guitar I'm going to get is the D28 Retro for sure. I mean, that is a killer guitar. It plays wonderful.
Well, I'm really surprised by them. The electronics has a lot of capability. It has more capability than most systems. It's not an easy system to use. You've got to read the manual a little bit and become familiar with it. But once you've done that, you really can take it in a lot of different directions. It's not chorus and phaser. It's not special effects. It's just getting a pure tone out of the guitar.
Do you guys think you'll be doing any like AB videos where you kind of do a direct box of, like, let's say the D28 versus the museum piece, out of curiosity?
Well, the paradox there is that then you're dependent upon the crappy little speakers in your computer. You really got to hear them in person. And, you know, even the amplification or sound system that you plug into has an impact on everything. So it's, I think it's best that people try them face to face.
Now, one of the things that Martin's been really leading the way on is using different woods and using sustainable woods. What are some of the different woods out there besides our standards of mahogany, rosewood, and Sitka spruce? What kind of woods are we going to see on Martin's, or are we seeing in Martin's that are a little bit different and outside the box?
You know, some of this happened as a result of my project with Sting, who everybody knows is a huge proponent for rainforest protection and responsible forestry and harvesting. With Sting, we developed a couple of models early on that were rainforest friendly, made with certified woods and FSC, Forest Stewardship Council certification. And what we found is that the guitar buying public needs a little bit of education about the viability of different woods. And what I realize is that you can build a guitar with just about any wood. You just have to build it correctly. If it's a really, really dense wood, perhaps you need to use it, sand it thinner, or brace it slightly differently. And so we've put a lot of effort and research into how we deal with different woods. There are woods from Central and South America that are certified. One is called Machiche. There's one called Cataloche. These days, we're starting to see mahogany that is plantation grown that is certified. We're starting to see occasional batches of spruce. Early on, we were getting spruce that was reclaimed from what we call diaper logs, logs that were going to be ground up into pulp to make baby diapers. And we would reclaim these logs, but they weren't certified. Now we're starting to see some certified spruce. And we've been able to build guitars that are the woods are 100% certified. Some of the woods are local to us, and local is good because it's pretty green to go local. We're using cherry from northwestern Pennsylvania. I guess what happened with cherry is that there was a huge fire in the early 1900s that burned a whole section of forest in northwestern Pennsylvania. And the cherry trees, for some reason, dominated and all grew concurrently so that they didn't have low branches. And they grew very, very tall and very, very straight in a huge forest of cherry. So Pennsylvania has a fantastic forest of certified cherry that we're using for the sustainable wood models. There's something else, and that's it's pretty important to not waste premium woods on low-cost guitars. So I think almost 15... about 15 years ago, we started making entry-level guitars using high-pressure laminate, which I hate to use the F word on the radio for mica, but it's most people would know it as a formica-like material, which is actually six or seven layers of craft paper that are fused together using pressure and resin. And the final layer is a photographic image of whatever you want. In our case, we use very beautiful images of wood. So these go into guitars that are called our X series. And we did a tremendous amount of work on the bracing, modifying the bracing until we arrived at a warm sound. It's very easy to get a tinny sound out of a entry-level guitar or a guitar made of these materials, but it's very difficult to get a warm sound. So we really did our homework. And those guitars are great for people that are beginning. We want beginners to have a Martin experience that's positive just as much as we want professionals to have that same experience.
I have a DXM, and it sounds great. It's a great sounding guitar.
So you know, there's a lot of things. There's also a material called Rich Light, which, ebony is particularly hard these days to acquire. And even though we have a fair amount of luck with that because we're willing to pay the price, we've developed Rich Light as a fingerboard material, which is pure black and somewhat synthetic, but it's dense and durable like ebony is. And we use it on the lesser expensive Martin guitars. And it looks great. It machines pretty well. It's actually a little harder to machine than ebony. But it takes the pressure off of ebony for the special guitars that like the D28 and up, and the custom shop instruments and all of those. So I think as we move into the future, these innovations are going to become more and more important.
Well, Dick, we're coming to the end of the show. If you wouldn't mind, we'd hang on after we're done. But I would definitely want to thank you for coming on. Let our listeners know that they can find out more about Martin at martinguitar.com. Also, there's a new app that Martin has that's available on iTunes and the Play Store. And there's a new Martin Owner Club coming out, so make sure you check that out. And once again, we want to thank our sponsor, Sweetwater, and thank Dick Boak.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
We'll see you guys, everybody, next week.